selections from the coming week's Sedra. Torah starts with the word V'hoya. V'hoya ki savo el ha'aretz. And Chazal comment that whenever it says V'hoya, it's Lashon Simcha. V'hoya is Simcha. I always like to explain why, and it says Vayehi is Lashon Tzar. Why the difference? So, Yehi is a future. The Vav turns it into past. Vayehi. So you have the Vay. When you take the future and you turn it to the past, that's a Tzara. The Hoya is just the opposite. Hoya is the past. The Vav changes it into the future. So when you take the past and you change it and give it a future, that's already Simcha. So, one of the Mefarshim learns, says, V'hoya kisavo al ha'aretz, that in order to fulfill the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael properly, you have to be happy. You have to be happy about it. Okay. Which probably is a big nesoyin, very difficult, because at the same time, Chazal say that Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is one of the mitzvahs that only comes with Yisurim. So it's hard to be happy with Yisurim. So what does that mean, that you have to be happy? Why do you have to be happy? Why is this a mitzvah that specifically you have to be happy about? So, one simple idea, before we go into the deeper ideas, is what is the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael? Yishuv Eretz Yisrael means to settle Eretz Yisrael. But it more specifically means to be settled in Eretz Yisrael. Settled does not only mean that you happen to live there. Settled means that you are settled in the land, which means that you need to be settled physically, economically. Right? In fact, there's a shita, the Avnei Nezer, who says that somebody who gets his whole parnasa from Chutz Laretz and lives in Eretz Yisrael is not mekayim the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. Right. We don't necessarily paschal like that. We don't necessarily paschal like that. Okay, but that's what he says. He lived in Poland. In any case, so you have to be settled in Eretz Yisrael. Settled also means emotionally settled. If you're not happy, you're not settled. You're an unsettled person. So in order to fulfill the mitzvah of being settled in Eretz Yisrael, you have to be happy. That's a surface idea. But there's a much deeper idea. The Ibn Ezra in Parshas Vayishlach says that someone who owns a plot of land in Eretz Yisrael is like he owns a share in the world to come. Owning land in Eretz Yisrael is like Olam Haba. Eretz Yisrael is like Olam Haba. What's the connection? The Meiri says that Olam Haba is the fruit of this world. In this world, you plant the seeds and you reap the fruit in the coming world. It's not two different worlds. That's the place that is the payoff for this world. That's what Olam Haba is. Now, we spoke about this at length at some other time. I'm not going to go into the details of it, just a basic idea. There's two philosophies of life. There is a secular philosophy of life: eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. This world is the place to amass toys, pleasure, and enjoy yourself in this world as much as you can, and that's the purpose of the world. The end goal of this life is pleasure. Enjoy yourself. Have a successful life. Pleasure comes in many forms and sizes, and that's the purpose of life. Torah standpoint, that's not the purpose of life. A person can enjoy this world, and he can get pleasure in this world, but it's not the goal. The goal is to use this world to create eternity. This is a means. It's not an end. The end goal is the world to come. And that is something that is special about Eretz Yisrael. It says that Avraham Avinu, before he was told Lech Lecha, to come and live here as a mitzvah, he made a pilot trip took a world cruise, and he made a pilot trip, and he first came to Aram Narayim in Chutz Laretz, and he saw a bunch of idol worshippers eating, drinking, and partying. So he said, Rabbanu Shalom, if you're going to give me a land for my children, if I ever have children, to grow up in, don't give me this one. Then he came to Eretz Yisrael, and he sees a bunch of idol worshippers planting, plowing, harvesting. He said, Rabbanu Shalom, if you're going to give me a land, this is the one I want. Now, on the surface, right, it's a great advertisement for the JNF, right? But what in the world did Avraham Avinu see better about a bunch of idol worshippers eating, drinking, and partying, or a bunch of idol worshippers planting, plowing, and harvesting? I mean, the goal of the Jewish people is not to be farmers, necessarily. Right? I live on a moshav, so maybe, but that's not necessarily the goal of Yiddishkeit, to be farmers. We have Shlosh Esrei Ikarim, but they're spelled with an ayin and a kuf, not an aleph and a chaf. So, what does it mean? What Avraham Avinu saw is that Chutz Laaretz is conducive to the kind of life of eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Meaning, pleasure as an end in itself. That is the atmosphere, it's an environment. It affects Jews, non-Jews, it affects everybody. That's part of the environment. Whereas Eretz Yisrael, the environment itself, even for Goyim, even for Ovdei Avodah Zarah, is more of a philosophy of put in effort now for a future goal. They put it in the context of plant, plow, and later on harvest. But Avraham said, it's in the air. My children will use it for put in the effort now for Olam Haba. And you see that. In Eretz Yisrael, even the Chalutzim, who were not from, right, the ones who were totally separated from Yiddishkeit, but they came here without the feeling of wanting to, what's it called, enjoy themselves. They came, they cleared the swamps, and they planted trees. They knew that they wouldn't be the beneficiaries. They did it for the future. So you see, it's in the air. Even idol worshippers have that feeling. And in Chutz La'aretz, it's in the air. The environment is eat, drink, and be merry. Right? That does not mean that you can't create a beautiful Torah society in Chutz La'aretz. There's plenty of them. But you have to fight against the environmental influence. And that doesn't mean that you can lead a non-Torah life in Eretz Yisrael. You can, unfortunately. But you have to fight against the environmental influence here. Here, if you go with the flow, you're going to have a Torah philosophy. You have to go against the flow to not have a Torah philosophy. In Chutz Laaretz, it's the opposite. And I'll tell you something that really made an impression on me years ago. Years ago, for those who were here for many years, you remember Shavua HaSefer used to be much different. Now it's basically all the bookstores have sales, and that's pretty much it. But it used to be that Shavua HaSefer lasted a week, not 2 months. And it was, what's it called? It was all of the publishers brought their new books or books they couldn't sell, whatever it was, to a central place in the city. Used to be in Gan HaPamon in Yerushalayim, and people would go out for a night out, religious people, it made no difference, to look at books, all different kinds of books. And they had them all in one place. It wasn't, you know, Torani and not, it was everything was all, everything mixed together. And everybody would come, and they had cotton candy for the kids, and they had, what's it called, and you would spend a few hours walking around tables with all these svarim on it, and looking at books, buying books, whatever it may be. So one year, I took my family, my kids were little kids at the time, and it was a night out. So we went to Yerushalayim, to Gan HaPamon, to Shavua HaSefer. And we spent the night walking around the tables, looking at books, foreign, whatever. That night, I had a flight to America. So we came home, I went to the airport, and next morning, I'm in New York. Get off the plane, New York. The person who met me said, there's something doing in Javits Convention Center that's very interesting. Maybe you'd like to go. So I said, what is it? He said, it's kosher food fair. What is that? All the producers of kosher food bring their latest products, and they put them on tables, you know, what's it called, miles long, in and everybody walks around and you taste the food and you try it out, you find out what new things are in kosher food. I said to myself, mate, this is unbelievable. I just left Eretz Yisrael, where people are walking around tables looking at Sfarim. Coming now to New York, where people are walking around tables looking at food. This got to say something about the difference between the atmosphere there and the atmosphere here. And that, not that I have anything against kosher food, believe me, I'm nothing against food, a little bit. Right? So kosher food especially. Nothing wrong with that. But if that becomes the focus of life, there's something wrong. Right? I saw then, since it was on my mind, I noticed in one of the newspapers, they had a number for a 24-hour hotline, kashrus hotline. Now, I can understand a hotline for other halachas, but kashrus? You wake up 4 o'clock in the morning, you want to know, is this Drake's cake heaven owe you or not? Right? Well, you can't wait till 8 o'clock in the morning to call your rabbi? You have to eat it at 4 o'clock in the morning? Why do you need a kashrus hotline at 4 o'clock in the morning? Right? So, that's the difference. The Mela, a person who lives in Eretz Yisrael is like he's living in Olam Haba, meaning he has, if he wants to open up his heart and his mind, right, to what the environment in Eretz Yisrael has to offer, it's the Olam Haba kind of philosophy, which means that no matter what happens, even the Yisurim you have to go through in this world is not an end in itself. This is merely a means to reach an end. And therefore, whatever difficulties you may have in this world, but it's all for an eternal benefit. In that light, a person can be happy even with difficulties. But if you look at this world as an end in itself, and you have a difficult life, then what's it all worth? There's no purpose to it, it's just tzaras. So you're very unhappy. But if you look at even the tzaras in this world as a stepping stone to something better eternally, then you can at least deal with the tzaras and overcome them, persevere with them, accept them as stepping stones to eternity. That's why v'hoyu. You have to have that simcha, and it's connected to the mitzvah bikurim, the fruit. Because if you understand the first fruits, you understand that Eretz Yisrael produces fruit. If you put in the work in this world, but the fruit is what you're looking for, the next world, then you can be happy in this world in any situation. That's the secret. And therefore, be mekayem the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is to appreciate and to get connected in to the atmosphere, the environment of Eretz Yisrael, which has to do a lot with the fruit. Memela, you have to be happy. You can be happy. That's the idea of a hoya kisavo, and why specifically it's related to the mitzvah bikurim. Okay, it says you come el hakohen asher yiyah bayomim hahen. You come to the Kohen who will be in your time. So the Gemara comments, Ein lecha Kohen ela shebiyomecha. You have to go to the Kohen of your time. Now that seems redundant and unnecessary to tell me, because how are you going to go to the Kohen some other time? You don't have a time machine. Can't go in the future. Can't go in the past. Right? So you have to. You're stuck with the Kohen in your time. We find the same thing, it says, by the Shofet. Ela Shofet asher yabayamahem. You go to the judge, the Torah leader of your time. So most of us think that that's Nebuch, the reality of the situation. I would rather go to the Vilna Gaon, if I had a Shaila. But Nebuch, the Vilna Gaon, is no longer here. So I have no choice. I have to go to the Torah leaders of my time, who are obviously not as great as the Vilna Gaon was. Right? And if I had my choice, I'd go to Rabbi Akiva or somebody great like that, but they're not around. So I'm stuck with the people in my generation. Rav Chaim Shmulevitz says no. Even if you could resurrect the Vilna Gaon, you wouldn't be allowed to go to him. If you could get Rabbi Akiva, you couldn't go to him. You know why? Because only the people of your generation understand your generation. Every generation, it says, Zechor Yomos Olam, remember the days of the world. Binu Shnostor Vador. Remember or understand Shnostor Vador. Shnostor Vador simply means the years of every generation. But there's another meaning. Shnos can mean the differences. Remember the differences of every generation. Every generation is different. Its problems are different. Its situation is different. Right? The conditions are different. And therefore, only a person who's familiar with that generation can really guide the people of that generation. Because you can't guide everybody equally. Everybody has to be guided according to the environment they grew up in, according to the environment they live in. Right? It's not one monolithic way for all Jews in all places at all times. Everything is different. And what may be good in one place is not good in another place, and what may be good in one time is not good in a different time. And therefore, the shofet, in order to give guidance and advice, has to know the generation. So you go to the shofet who's in your generation because that's what's proper. Not only because it can't be any other way. But even if it could be another way, you'd still have to go to the shofet who's familiar with your time. If that's the case, the shofet is the one who gives you advice and judges or whatever. The kohen is the one who gives you spiritual guidance. That's the kohen. Even when it comes to spiritual guidance, no two generations, no two places, no two people are the same. A connection to the Rabbanu Shalom in one generation is different than a connection in a different generation. Right? And therefore, you have to go to the Kohen who knows your generation, because only he can give you that connection to God. Because the connection for different generations, for different places, for different people, is all different. There's no one derech to the Rabbanu Shel Olam that's monolithically for everybody. Everybody has, at least in some way, variations of there's many paths to the Rabbanu Shel Olam, and each generation has its specific path, and therefore you can go to the Kohen of your generation to give you spiritual guidance, just like you have to go to the shofet of your generation to give you more physical guidance. Okay. Next, when we bring the Bikurim, bring our first fruits. So the mitzvah of Bikurim is basically an expression of Hakaras HaTov. Higadati Ayom, Rashi says, She'eni Kofui Tova. I'm not ungrateful. I brought my fruit, the first fruits, to show you, Rabbanu Shalom, that I'm grateful for what you gave me. Now, when you bring the first fruits, you make a declaration. Kriyas Bikurim. And that Kriya goes and redacts Jewish history. Arami Ovirov, we start with Lavan, who wanted to kill Yaakov, and he went down to Mitzrayim. And that's what we say in the Haggadah. It's the shortest, most succinct four sentences that deal with Mitzrayim. So that Pesach night, that's what we use for the drushes of the Haggadah, those four sentences. So the obvious question is, I'm bringing my first fruits. Why do I have to go through a whole course of Jewish history to bring my first fruits? Just say, Rabbanu Shalom, thank you for the fruit. Why do you have to say, well, we got the land, and we went to Mitzrayim, and then you took us out, and you gave us the land, and now I have the tree, and I have the fruit? Why do you have to go and trace it back so much? Just be thankful for what you have. The answer is that the whole concept of Hakaras HaTov is a principle. It's a foundation in Judaism. In fact, all sins come from the fact that we are not grateful to God. We don't recognize the goodness that we get from God. That's what it says. Yoda shor konehu. An ox knows its owner. The chamor evus balav. And a donkey knows where it gets its food from. And we don't know that. Because if we would know it, we would obviously relate to the Rabbanu Shalom differently. We wouldn't sin. And that's why when a person sins and he's liable to lashes, we hit him with a donkey leather because of this pasuk. Because you're like a donkey. You're worse than a donkey. The donkey knows to be grateful to the one who feeds it. And you weren't grateful. So the whole idea of recognizing God is recognizing good. God is the ultimate good. So we can't see God. So how do you know him? Hatov v'hametiv. God is the ultimate good who does good. So if you recognize the good in the world, you'll recognize God. So therefore, recognizing good and being grateful is what's called is a foundation of Yiddishkeit. However, if you recognize the good and you attribute it to your own power, then you're not going to come to see God from that. What you have to do is recognize the good and realize that it didn't come from what you see in front of you. There was a prior cause, which a prior cause to that, and eventually get back to the first cause. The example they like to give is a baby. Baby drinks a bottle. So he feels that he owes gratitude to the bottle for giving him milk. Bottle gives him milk. So every day he, what's it called, thanks the bottle, thank you bottle for the milk, for it. We appreciate it, really great, whatever. Okay. Baby gets a little bit older, and he sees that the mother pours the milk from a container. So, oh boy, I'm making a terrible mistake. I've been giving credit to the bottle when it's really the container that gives milk. So for the next few weeks, he thanks the container. Gets a little bit older, crawls into the kitchen. He sees the mother takes the container out of the refrigerator. Oh, no, refrigerators give milk. So now he's thanking the refrigerator, right? Gets a little bit older, right? He finds out that they sell milk in the store. So he thanks the store, right? Then he gets a little bit older, goes out into the country. He sees cows give milk. Thanks the cow. Then he realizes the cow eats the grass. So he thanks the grass. Eventually, where's he going to end up? By the first cause, which is God. If you trace things back to their source, you're going to come back to the first cause, which is God. So anything that you see that you benefit from is all secondary causes. So if you recognize the good and you trace it back to its source, you'll come to recognize God. That's what we do with Bikurim. We bring the fruit. But if you recognize the fruit, so I planted the fruit. I fertilized it. I harvested it. So I'll take the credit myself. But no, where did I get the koach to do it? Where did I get the hands? Where did I get the feet? Forget about that. Where did I get the farm implements? Who gave me the land? How did I get here? So if you trace everything back to its source, you'll come back to the Ribono Shel Olam. So in order to make Hakaras HaTov, recognizing good and having gratitude, make it the ultimate recognition of God, at the same time you have to trace it back to its source. So that's what we do. We bring the Bikurim and we trace it. We don't look just at the immediate thing in front of us. We trace it back to its source. Could be that's why Ashrei is so special. The Gemara says whoever says Ashrei three times a day is Muftach Lushu Ben Olam Haba, Tilo L'David. And the Gemara says that because Ashrei has two things that are special about it. One is it's in the Aleph Beis format, and it has the sentence Poseach Es Yodecha. I was thinking maybe that's this idea. Poseach Es Yodecha says that God provides for everybody. But I don't necessarily see that. I see that the bottle provides, or the refrigerator provides, or whatever. How do you know God provides? Because you have to trace things back to their source. So if you have an orderly Aleph Beis, and you trace everything back from the Tuf to the Aleph, you come back to the first cause, the Aleph, the Ribono Shel Olam of everything. So those two sentences together. I recognize that God provides for everything. But understanding how you can then trace everything back to the Ribono Shel Olam through the secondary causes, that is Muftach Lushu Ben Olam. If you live a life like that, understanding that, that everything you have comes from the Ribono Shel Olam, then you'll do what the Ribono Shel Olam wants because you know that he's your beneficiary. So therefore, a person who says Tila L'David three times a day and understands that and lives like that is Muftach Lushu Ben Olam Haba. Okay, the last of the klolos that are given is Orer Asher Lo Yokim Es Divrei HaTorah Azos La'Asos Osa. So the various meanings, what is this? It can't be a curse for people who don't keep the whole Torah. Because if it is, we're all in big tzaras. Because we've got a curse. Because nobody keeps the whole Torah. I mean, it's almost impossible. Right? None of us are perfect. Right? I'll speak for myself. Maybe people here are. It's very difficult to keep the whole Torah. So if there's a curse on people who don't keep the whole Torah, it's very, very... So what is it going on? So Rabbeinu Yonah says, it's going on a person who does not accept the whole Torah. Yokim doesn't mean to fulfill, it means to accept, to commit to. And that means that if you have somebody who keeps, let's say, 600 mitzvahs, 13 of them are very difficult for him. Okay, just can't do them. Can't do them. He speaks Lashon Hara, a few things that he just can't control. He knows it's wrong, he knows he's going to get Gehenna for it, just can't control himself. And he feels bad about it, but what can I do? I just can't do it. And then you have another person who keeps 612 mitzvahs. but he doesn't accept one of them. One of them is not, I don't accept it. Right? I don't feel guilty about not doing it. I only believe in 612 mitzvahs. Who's better? The guy who keeps 600 mitzvahs or even 500 mitzvahs, but accepts them all and knows that the ones that he doesn't do, he's going to be punished for, and it's wrong not to do them? Or the person who accepts 612 and keeps them all perfectly, just one mitzvah doesn't do, but doesn't accept it? The answer is, the person who accepts 613 mitzvahs just does not fulfill them all because he has a Yetzer Hara, is still part of the Jewish people. He has a Torah of 613 mitzvahs, he's just not a tzaddik. But the person who doesn't accept 613 mitzvahs doesn't have a Torah. He has a different Torah, a Torah with 612 mitzvahs. He's out of the pale of the Jewish people. He's called a mummer. So somebody who doesn't accept the entire Torah, that's who the curse is given to. Not the person who doesn't fulfill the entire Torah. That's the Rabbeinu Yonah. But the Chasam Sofer says, it's talking about the following. Or ha'isha shelo yokim es divrei ha-Torah zos. A person who will not fulfill the Torah, la so, because he thinks by not fulfilling the Torah, he's going to preserve the Torah. Example. Conservative, early conservative Jews in America, right? Some of them were l'shem shamayim. They said, Torah, Orthodox Judaism cannot survive in America. It's going to die out. Right, the last vestiges are the old people, and it's dying out with them. We need to conserve Judaism. What's conservative Judaism, right? It's something when you have a commodity and it's getting wasted, used up, you need to conserve it, not use it too much. So therefore, we will what's it called? Conserve Judaism. And we'll do it by transgressing certain things, but for the sake of preserving Judaism. Therefore, they said like this, if we keep men and women separate during davening, people aren't going to come to shul. So we'll break down the mechitza, let husbands and wives sit together, and even better, husbands sit next to somebody else's wife, right? And that will draw people to shul. If we tell people you have to walk to shul, they're not going to walk in from the suburbs. And we can't build shuls all over, right? So therefore, we'll let them drive. But we're letting them drive because that way shuls will fill up. So we're not keeping the Torah, but lasso in order to preserve the Torah. That's a philosophy. What does the Torah say? Or, cursed is such a person. It doesn't work. Why? Because the Rabbi Yisrael Salanter gives the following marshal. Why it's not valid. He says that there was once two kings, King Reuven and King Shimon, and they had made a bet. I heard this in many ways, but this is the way I like it best, so I'm going to tell you the way this way. The King Reuven bet King Shimon that he can get his prime minister to disrobe publicly. He bet him $1 million that if King Shimon sends his prime minister to King Reuven's land for a week, within that week, King Reuven can get King Shimon, prime minister, to disrobe publicly. King Shimon says, my prime minister may not be the smartest guy in the world, but he's not an idiot. There's no way he's going to undress publicly, right? I'll take the bet. He said, fine, you can tell him anything you want, just can't tell him about the bet. So King Shimon calls his prime minister in, and he says, look, I'm sending you to King Reuven's land for a week. Do whatever you want over there. Just promise me one thing. You will not undress publicly. The guy says, don't worry about it. Never was thinking about it, right? Not going to undress publicly there. No, he goes to King Reuven's land. He's there for a few days. King Reuven calls him in. And he says, I've been observing you. And you are one of the best statesmen I've ever seen in my life. And it's amazing to me that a hunchback like you could be such a great statesman. The guy says, hunchback? I'm not a hunchback. He says, sure, you're a hunchback. He said, no, I'm not a hunchback. I never was a hunchback. He says, yeah, you're a hunchback and you're a great statesman. And it amazes me. The guy says, I'm not a hunchback. He says, of course you are. And I'm so sure you're a hunchback, I'll bet you $500,000 that you're a hunchback. The guy says, it's ridiculous. I know I'm not a hunchback. Right? This is a sure bet. Sure win. So he says to the king, well, how can I prove to you I'm not a hunchback and win the $500,000? He says, very simple. I'm going to call my whole court in and you're going to get undressed in front of them. If they say you're not a hunchback, I lose. You win $500,000. If they say you are a hunchback, you lose, I get the $500,000. I said, this is unbelievable. The guy said, I'm not. I know I'm not a hunchback. Nobody's going to say I'm a hunchback. Then he remembers the king told him not to undress publicly. He said, but if the king would know I could make $500,000, he never would have told me that. So he'll be happy. I'll get the $500,000. I'll give him $250,000. I'll keep $250,000. Everybody's going to be happy. This is a sure thing. So he gets undressed publicly in front of the whole court, and they all look and they say, this guy's not a hunchback. So the king says, okay, I lose. Gives him $500,000. He runs back to the king and he says, look, you're going to hear something. I know you're going to be upset, but before you get upset, listen to the whole story. He said, you told me not to undress publicly, right? But I made $500,000 by undressing publicly. The king says, you idiot. You didn't gain me if you give me the whole $500,000, you lost me $500,000. Right? You don't think I knew you could have made $500,000? But you lost $500,000. That's what the Rabbanu Shlom said. I told you to keep Shabbos. You think you're going to benefit me, right? Do me a favor by letting people drive on Shabbos? You don't think that I knew that more people would come to shul if they could drive? But the loss from Chilul Shabbos so much overshadows the gain you see. You're not gaining $500,000, you're losing $500,000. It's always like that. What we see as the gain from going against the Torah never is as great as the loss that's going against the Torah. That's the idea. So somebody who thinks they're going to compromise on the Torah in order to benefit the Torah, that's not a thing. The Chofetz Chaim says two other mishalim and an idea. He says you want to give God a present. The halacha is, well, if you want to give somebody a present, you have to let them know you're giving them a present. Because maybe he doesn't want the present. Said, you want to do God a favor. You want to give him a present. You want to present him with more people in shul, but you're doing it by being Mechal Shabbos. Did you ask God if he's interested in your present? You want to give somebody a present, ask him. Right? Don't force your presence on God, right, when maybe he's not interested. Also, the Chofetz Chaim says, there was a maisa like this. There was a decree against the Frum community in Poland, Frum Jews in Poland, by the Polish government. Now, the Rabbonim didn't know Polish. They only knew Yiddish. So if they went to plead their case in front of the Tsar or the officials, they had to bring somebody who knew Polish and Yiddish so he could be the go-between, their interpreter. And since most Frum Jews didn't know other languages, they had to take a maskil, a guy who wasn't Frum. So they took a Jewish lawyer who was a maskil, he wasn't so Frum, and he knew Polish and Yiddish. So they're sitting on the train, Chofetz Chaim and a few other rabbonim are going to plead the case of Frum Jewry, and the lawyer says to the Chofetz Chaim, where would you religious Jews be without me, the maskil, who knows Polish and can help you plead your case in front of the officials? Chofetz Chaim looks him in the eye and he says, I'll tell you a story. He said, there's two versions of the story, I'll tell you both of them. One goes like this. He said, it used to be that if you got frostbite, the first aid for frostbite was rubbing it with snow. To rub it with snow, and that would help. Today, they don't think that helps. But it used to be, that was the thing, rub it with snow. He said, what idiot would say, oh, if it wasn't for snow, where would we be if we had frostbite? If it wasn't for snow, you wouldn't have frostbite to begin with. The second version is, Chofetz Chaim said, I once saw a man jump into a hole in the ice and save somebody else's life who fell into the hole. And I went over to him and said, I envy you that you risked your life to save another Jew. He said, don't envy me. I dug the hole. So too says the Chofetz Chaim, without people like you, we wouldn't have the problems to begin with. It's because we have people like you around that the problems exist, and now we need you to help us. If it wouldn't be for the snow, we wouldn't have frostbite. Now that we have frostbite, the snow helps out. If it wouldn't be that the guy dug the hole, the other guy wouldn't have been in danger. Now you dug the hole, you caused the other guy to fall in, now you're the ones who are going to save him. You dug the hole. Without you, we wouldn't have those tzaras. And it's interesting, because I was thinking that it really fits in the following context. There are a lot of people, and I will consider myself one of them, who, because of conservative temples and even conservative rabbis, became Frum. Originally, my parents belonged to a conservative temple. I went through that thing, And because of them, I used that as a stepping stone to go on to a frum thing. And the conservative rabbi helped me. Very Muslim, very Makar Tova to him. I even mentioned him in my first Sefer. So, Lechora, without conservative Judaism, there would be people who wouldn't be frum. So, see, it does serve a purpose. The answer is that had it not been for conservative Judaism, what would have been in America? Right? If there wasn't, we'd be like England, like South Africa to a certain degree, where there was never conservative and reform. Or reform, there was, but not conservative for sure not. And all the shuls were basically government, you know, what's it called, shuls. Some a little more, a little less from, but they all believed in Torah Menashemayim. That means if you went to the shul, you didn't hear that it's okay to drive on Shabbos. You may have not heard anything, but you knew that the rabbi held it's not okay. So there was hope that someday you, your children, will pick up on it and become Shomer Shabbos. But if you have a conservative place, it tells you it's okay to drive on Shabbos, there's no hope. Right? It's like your person who's sick, who's told that you have what's it called, medicine, when it's only a placebo. If you know you're not taking medicine, you may go get the medicine one day. But if you think you're taking the medicine, then there's no hope. If there hadn't been conservative, so people, most people would have gone to a shul. Most people don't want to totally separate themselves from the Jewish people. So they would have gone to a frum shul, and eventually they would have heard something, you know, of what Yiddishkeit is all about. They may not have accepted, their children may have accepted it. But now that there's some milk toast in between, people opt for that. They don't have that choice anymore, nothing or yes. They have something in between. And that something in between now led more people away than ever led people to. So had it not been, the problems wouldn't be. That created the problem, which they solved minimally, but Lamaisa, it's like if there hadn't been snow, there wouldn't have been frostbite to begin. That's the basic idea. So therefore, the Torah gives a klala. Or Ashelo Yokim is Divrei HaTorah Zos. Cursed is a person who doesn't fulfill the Torah, even if his kavanah is l'shem shamayim. I'm doing it in order to do God a favor. Don't do God any favors. Keep the Torah. Because the loss of not keeping the Torah always outweighs what you perceive as the gain.